It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump has called for an end to mail-in voting. Wisconsin was among the first states in the nation to allow absentee voting in the 1860s. In a Tuesday post to a social media platform, the president called for the removal of mail-in ballots and vote tabulation machines. He falsely claimed that they lead to massive voter fraud. He also falsely claimed that elections can never be honest with mail-in voting. In Wisconsin, more than 400,000 people mailed their ballots in the 2022 midterm election. To discuss the president's comments and the security of Wisconsin elections, we turn to a pair of state lawmakers who serve on the seven-member Assembly Committee on Campaigns and Elections. Republican Representative Dave Maxey of New Berlin chairs the committee. He serves a district in the southeastern part of the state. And Democratic Representative Lee Snodgrass of Appleton also sits on the committee. Snodgrass serves a district in the east central part of the state, which includes most of Appleton, a portion of Grand Chute. Welcome to you both.
Thank you so much.
Good morning.
Representative Maxey, starting with you, do you support President Trump's call to end mail-in voting?
Well, you know, I'm torn on the issue. I've never been a fan of voting early myself, but in recent years have done it. But I go early in person.
Do you have specific concerns about mail-in voting? What is on your mind about it?
Well, to me, mail-in voting is a lot like a self-checkout. Dishonest people are going to do dishonest things, and it just gives them a greater ability to do that.
I'm going to read this directly from the Republican Party of Wisconsin website. It says, in part, banking your vote early and encouraging others to do so is crucial because it helps secure additional votes from Republicans who might not have voted otherwise. From this, it seems that the Wisconsin GOP is not supportive of the president's goals in elections. What do you see and hear in your party?
Well, that's where the conflict comes in, right? I've heard that as well, and I know both parties are encouraging people to vote early. There's some giant advantages if you're one of these people who's tired of the constant phone calls and knocks on your door. You're supposed to be able to identify those individuals that have voted early so that you can redirect your resources to those who haven't. Personally, I like going on the day of. I get to go and meet and talk with the poll workers who I don't necessarily see as often as I'd like. That way I can thank them in person. And there's something about being standing in a line, even though it may be short or long, depending on the volume of people. But being able to meet and talk to your neighbors and just kind of, you know, that whole communal thing of voting is missed when we all vote via mail or early in person.
Representative Snodgrass, President Trump has claimed that elections can never be honest with voting by mail. How important is mail-in voting in Wisconsin and with your constituents?
It's extremely important, and the president's comments are clearly false and frankly politically motivated. It's a strategy ahead of the midterms that casts any doubt on any election results that don't have Republican wins. You know, Representative Maxey was talking about his preference to vote in person. It is a preference that needs to be allowed for all voters. Not all voters have the ability to go on election day, work, family obligations, illness, etc. I often vote early in person because on election day, I'm busy talking to voters. So making sure that we still have the ability to vote early by mail or dropping it off at your clerk's office or a designated ballot drop box location is quite simply democratic.
So if the safest way to vote is only at your local precinct, only in line that day, only on election day, what impact would that have? Would that disenfranchise voters?
Absolutely. I mean, Wisconsin saw a 40% increase in 2024 compared to 2020 in absentee ballot voting or mail-in ballots. This is clearly a preference of a number of individuals. And the goal for us in the legislature, in the country, should be to encourage as many people to vote as possible and making all of those methods of voting safe and secure, but available to the people who need them.
Representative Maxey, here in Wisconsin, do you think have we proved the safety of voting by mail? Have we passed the threshold of it being safe here?
Well, I don't think we have to look any further than the irregularities that happened in Madison to understand why people have questions. I think at the end of the day, the most important thing is election integrity. Everyone in Wisconsin, whether they're Republican or Democrat, should know beyond the shadow of a doubt at the end of the day, on election day, what the outcome is. And when we have irregularities with 190 some votes not being counted in Madison, where in another case where absentee mail forms were sent out with duplicate ballots or multiple ballots, man, I really have to question that. And I certainly understand why people question the integrity of an election when things like that occur. Now, I know that their clerk in Madison has resigned, but
And I want to jump in here as you talk about the investigation that found a clerk in Madison oversaw a range of errors that resulted, as you mentioned, in nearly 200 ballots going uncounted in the 2024 presidential election. And the Elections Commission called the issues in Madison structural in nature. What reforms are needed in your mind?
Well, I think unfortunately we're going to go back to just kind of a lack of integrity on some people's behalf, and I don't know how you accidentally double stuff envelopes, with multiple ballots. You know that everybody gets one vote, so when an envelope is addressed to an individual, you don't put two ballots in it. There's also just the fact that they weren't forthcoming in the fact that they didn't count 190 some ballots.
But the error was caught.
The error was caught, but that's 190 people who didn't get to vote in that election.
We are talking about President Trump seeking to eliminate mail-in voting, saying he wants to lead a movement to end the use of absentee voting, get rid of voting machines. We have Representatives Dave Maxey here and Lede Snodgrass, two members of the state's Committee on Campaigns and Elections. Representative Snodgrass, President Trump has also called for the potential end of some vote tabulating machines. And Don Millis, a Republican member of the State Elections Commission, told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that that move would delay the time needed to count votes by weeks. What effect do you think that could have on democracy?
Well, we already part of the reason that we have people who continue to bang the drum about some perceived election fraud is because it takes a long time to process those absentee ballots. We've talked about a Monday process bill that would enable clerks on the Monday before election to check the envelopes, open them up, get them ready, not feed them into the tabulator until election day, but to do that early processing, which would save an enormous amount of time and would shorten that window where we have those unofficial election results, hopefully on election night instead of, in the early morning hours or the next day. So when you talk about eliminating voting machines, we're going to extend that window again. And once again, fuel the perception. That's what this is about. This is about planting a seed early before the midterms to fuel the perception that somehow US elections are inherently not, filled with fraud or don't have integrity. Voting machine fraud claims have been debunked many times. In fact, we have even seen defamation lawsuits being paid out for Fox News because of their claims that the Dominion voting machines were somehow false. I mean, they had an $800 million settlement. There have been 60 lawsuits across many states from Trump and his allies aim to overturn the 2020 election results, that have been dismissed. There is not an issue with rampant fraud or even a minimal amount of fraud in election voting machines or absentee ballots. This is a false narrative, and we have to put a stop to it.
Representative Maxey, your colleague, Republican Representative Scott Krug, vice chair of the Campaigns and Elections Committee, has expressed support for a bill to allow election clerks to process absentee ballots earlier to avoid the so-called election night ballot dumps. Would you support this type of legislation?
I have in the past. And I've got to tell you, I believe it would speed up the process, because at the end of the day, we need those results to come in much earlier than they have been. I know part of the issue is that due to COVID, we allowed or expanded mail-in ballots, which increased the number dramatically, which then results in more ballots that have to be counted that came in that way. That did slow everything down and has results coming in at 2-3 in the morning. If those ballots were processed, at least verifying that there were the individual had completed the ballot, signed the ballot, was witnessed by an individual in advance. Two things can happen. You can identify any errors and allow your clerks to get in touch with those people so they could correct those ballots in advance of election day. And you would be able to get those results much earlier at night. And when they're not coming in at 2 in the morning with ballot dumps, when we were all told that they had stopped counting for the night, you would have more people believing in the election results.
Well, Representatives Maxey and Snodgrass, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
That is Republican Representative Dave Maxey of New Berlin, chair of the Assembly Committee on Campaigns and Elections, and Democratic Representative Lee Snodgrass of Appleton, serving a district in the east central part of the state. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the liquid byproduct of cheese making is whey, and it's transforming Wisconsin agriculture. Hear from a master cheesemaker in Marshfield about the potential for new whey protein products that could translate into big business growth for the dairy industry.
It's now representing this bigger and bigger piece of the milk check. You know, this is where the future is.
That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Decades ago, the liquid byproduct from cheesemaking, whey, was considered a waste product. Some farmers spread it on their fields or fed it to their hogs to get rid of it. Today, it's a very different story. A surge in protein demand has led to a spike in whey production. You'll find it in shakes and supplements and even as a strategy in obesity treatment. The global market values for whey varies. The USDA estimates it's a $5 to $10 billion industry. Other market analysts say whey protein is a $12 billion global industry and growing fast. So how is this protein boom changing Wisconsin agriculture? Master cheesemaker Ken Hyman is co-owner of Nasonville Dairy near Marshfield. The plant produces about 185,000 pounds of cheese a day. And Kevin Draper is a New York Times business correspondent covering the agricultural industry. He traveled to central Wisconsin to report out a story titled America's Protein Obsession is Transforming the Dairy Industry. Kevin and Ken, welcome to you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
This is Ken, and thank you for having us here in Wisconsin.
Ken, let's start with you. You've been immersed in the cheese industry your whole life, your parents buying Nasonville in the 1960s. The rest is history. When did you realize whey was starting to outpace cheese in your industry and affecting your bottom line?
Actually, that actually goes back to the 60s. In the 60s, what happened was we began to get into whey proteins very early, late 60s, early 70s. And what that is, you know, that was just 34% protein. None of the new technologies had been developed. This is just what was there. And you could see that it had potential at that point, and it has continued to evolve from that point.
Was there a learning curve with whey? Like, you didn't become a master cheesemaker overnight. You had to learn the craft over time to become that master cheesemaker. Is there an art to learn with processing whey?
There's an art to learn. I guess the biggest thing about it is learning, you know, what does that mean when I say that I have a 34% protein? You know, well, how far can I push the limit before I can get to the 90? How far can I go that I can transport it? When will it settle out? When will the sugars fall out of it? There's so many different things that go with it that you learn by the school of hard knocks in a lot of cases. And it's become, you know, there's people out there that evolve themselves in finding the new avenues in which we are going to continue to use proteins.
So when the whey leaves your plant, who is your customer? Where does it go?
Well, a lot of ours will go to Actis Nutrition, because we are centrally located and they have plants in Minnesota and in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. And so, you know, and then they have some in Iowa. So what it allows them to do is it allows them to select where they would like this to go. And then they are bouncing. A lot of times when you build a plant that's unique to a certain protein, you become immersed in that, and that becomes your whole livelihood. What this allows us to do is we became the supplier to Actis. And what Actis does is they find out which item of today, next week, that they're going to need the most of, and then they push the protein to that point.
Hmm. Kevin, you have been tracing how whey has become a big business. Can you give us some numbers? How big?
Yeah, it can be a little hard to tell. It depends upon, you know, what we're talking about. When we talk about whey, Ken mentioned sort of there's this difference in protein content. You have the standard or 34% protein content whey, and then you have sort of what we're talking about a lot when we talk about protein powders with this 80 plus or 90 percent of that whey is protein. But it's anywhere from a $5 to $10 billion business a year. And the sort of important thing to know is that basically everyone projects that in the next decade, that's going to double. That sort of this thing is growing 10% or more every single year and is expected to continue doing that for the foreseeable future.
Why is that?
It's sort of a convergence of a number of factors. One is sort of just the technological and scientific ability to consistently get that really high protein whey. But really, it's a demand story. It is more and more people demanding these protein products. And some of it is sort of we have an aging population. And as you age, you often lose muscle mass. And so doctors are increasingly prescribing or sort of advising their patients to do things like lift weights, you know, not necessarily deadlift hundreds of pounds, but do a little bit of weightlifting and eat a little bit more protein. Sort of the trendy diets or sort of the food styles that people are into tend to emphasize protein. And then a big part of this is Ozempic and sort of these other drugs that are, you know, weight loss drugs. When you take them, you lose weight. And a lot of that weight you lose is muscle. People are losing muscle mass on them. And so just like with aging patients, doctors are prescribing patients on these drugs, sort of a regimen of weightlifting or these other kind of high impact exercise activities. And they need to eat more protein. And it's hard for them to eat more protein because these drugs, you know, make them feel more satiated, make them feel more full. And so maybe eating a big steak and getting a lot of protein out of it is hard for them. But it is easier if they can eat sort of a small bar that is packed with whey protein. And so sort of all of those things have been converging, you know, some from decades ago, some from only a few years ago, to make this a time when whey protein is in heavy demand.
Ken, when your family bought Naysonville more than 60 years ago, how was Way being used then, and how does that compare to now?
There was no comparison. When we bought it, when we bought the plant or whatever, Way was an absolute byproduct. And what I mean by a byproduct, it had no value to me. I would actually take it out and land spread it, or I would take it out and feed it to hogs. And that was kind of the end of it when we started. We didn't have as much, nowhere near, but it did not have a value.
And now it has a much greater value to your business. Can you talk about how much compared to cheese?
In the value scheme of things, it's gotten to be where we don't know what the full potential is. It's gotten to a point now that we know that it represents over 23% of our total dollars coming in, and it will be immensely, it'll continue to grow to know to a point that we don't know where that point is. I mean, as Kevin had talked about, there's all new products out there. There's so many new things coming. We found so many ways to fractionate proteins to make into new items, the new bars, the new drinks, the new things that are coming on. And we're getting to a more and more native milk protein as well. And these things are so pure and our body accepts them so well. As the doctors and a lot of the medical people know, this is where we want to go to.
We're talking about how the protein trend is affecting the dairy industry. We have Kevin Draper, a New York Times business correspondent covering the egg industry, wrote about the increased demand for whey, the liquid byproduct of cheese, how it's impacting the dairy industry. And Ken Hyman is here, master cheesemaker and owns Naysonville Dairy in Marshfield. Kevin, you know, let's go up the supply chain here. How is demand for whey affecting farmers with dairy cattle?
Yeah, it's sort of a convoluted process in how dairy farmers get paid for their milk, but they are for sure seeing the impact of whey. We could spend this entire program talking about the federal milk marketing order system and laws passed in the 1930s, but we will save that, I think, for another
day,
program.
Another day.
another day. But basically, sort of dairy farmers get a pretty low price for their milk, and they do not particularly have a lot of room to maneuver. There is sort of more supply usually than demand, and so they sort of have to accept the price that they're given. And the way the price works is sort of it's affected by all the different ways milk could be used. And so we're talking about butter, milk, ice cream, cheese, lactose, whey, sort of all these things that milk go into, and what the demand for them is and what the cost for those are, they sort of all get totaled up into sort of a price that farmers receive for their milk. And sort of in the last two decades, I had an economist do some calculations, and sort of it's essentially doubled, that whey used to make up somewhere in the 5 to 6 percentage points of the milk check that a farmer got. 5 to 6% of what they got for their milk was how it was being used in whey. And now that is sort of doubled. It depends on the month, but we're talking 10, 11, 12% of the check they receive is made up from whey. And it's not that they've gotten rich off that. It's sort of more that that has kept them afloat. That sort of if whey didn't have this increased value, you would probably see more dairy farmers getting out of dairy or going bankrupt or not sort of being able to get by. And whey has pushed some of them over the top to, you know, being able to continue to sustain operations, not making them rich, but certainly making a big difference in their livelihood.
Certainly, dairy farm bankruptcies have been a huge issue here in Wisconsin. Ken, you work so closely as well with dairy farmers. What have you heard them telling you about whey?
Well, undoubtedly, what they're learning, they're still in this learning stage about understanding, is there something that I can do different? Is there something I can do, as Kevin's saying, when it gets to feeding programs, what can I do that will enhance you to make my milk worth more? It's always about making my milk worth more. Is it that I'm using A2 proteins? Am I doing, what am I doing that's going to make the product that I'm producing worth more to you, which means I can get more for it, you know, from you. And so that's what it's gotten down to. They're very interested in understanding what's this going to do and how can we work with it. And so that's kind of where it's at.
I wonder, Kevin, you know, China is a big market for whey that comes from the U.S. And right now that triggers certainly a question about tariff policies and access to foreign markets. And I just wonder if tariffs will affect the whey market, or is it too soon to tell?
I think that the answer is sort of undoubtedly yes. The question is sort of to what extent. Generally, tariffs affect dairy a little bit less than other agricultural products because a lot of dairy products are sort of really hard to transport. You know, we don't have tanker ships of milk, you know, going from here to Europe or something like that. It's just cost prohibitive. But when you talk about whey, that is a product that, you know, a lot of it does get sold around the world to be used in baby formula, to be used in sort of animal feed, and some cases sort of as this high protein whey, because it is now not a liquid, large volume product, but it is sort of a really compact powder product. And so undoubtedly, sort of as there are tariffs that will affect some of the milk we get from Ireland and some other places, and as countries place retaliatory tariffs on the United States, it may make it more expensive for them to, you know, import whey from the United States. And so, you know, we might expect the price of the stuff to drop a little bit if there is less demand, but with our sort of tariff policy ping-ponging around a little bit, changing every day, having sort of unclear effects, I think it's probably too soon to say exactly what it will do.
Ken, do you have an eye on international demand, or are you mostly concerned about serving markets closer to home in Wisconsin and domestic?
I think we'll pick on China because they are Chinese, are people in China that buy from us, has on the cheese side has pretty much come to a screeching halt at the moment. But on the whey protein side, they're still buying. To them, there's enough value there to make it worthwhile to them. They, you know, they complain a lot about the whey protein, about the price, but you know, they continue to buy. I'm sure it's down. I'm sure that they would be buying more. But so we need to address where we're going to get and how we're going to get there. But we do see it. Yes. As Kevin said, we know that it shows up and their cheese orders have dropped to virtually nothing. But their protein orders, they were trying to push everything they could to get it in before the tariffs were going to take a major effect. And as Kevin said, there is a bit of latitude there. You know, if we're doing something that's humanitarian and a few other things, some of it gets a little bit less of a tariff.
Kevin, back to you. You know, you cover all of agriculture. I wonder, you know, as you continue to watch the dairy industry evolve, we've got cheese industry changing and adapting with whey. What are you watching for next?
I mean, always watching for tariffs. You know, I mentioned there isn't too much dairy trade, but there is a decent dairy trade with Canada. You know, a lot of our milk is located Wisconsin, Michigan, New York, the dairy industry has wanted a larger foothold into Canada for a long time. So what happens with Canada, what happens with Mexico, and sort of the tariffs within North America are a pretty big story. Another big one is just sort of consumer demand. That, you know, as well as Ken runs his business and dairy farms run their business, you know, they're sort of ultimately, they respond to consumer demand. And so are people, you know, going to continue to want cheese? What kind of cheese will they want? We drink less milk sort of as a country as we used to. Will that trend continue? You know, where are people going with vegetarianism and veganism and how that may affect their dairy input? You know, it's not quite dairy. But obviously, we had huge issues with eggs and egg supply and where the egg supply is. And so a lot of it is what people want and how manufacturers like Ken, how farmers are able to respond to that or not able to respond to that and how that affects their prices. You know, the great thing about being on the agriculture beat is there are a million interesting things going on. And the terrible thing about the agriculture beat is that there are a million interesting things going on. And so you've kind of got to look and watch all of it and try to make a decision on when something is important enough or when it is interesting enough to really dive into it.
All right, Ken, final question to you, being a family business here. You're always thinking about the next generation of owners and ensuring that you're leaving it in good hands for that next generation. Is Way helping you sleep at night? Do you think Way is going to be that transition for the next generation of Naysonville Dairy?
I don't think there's a question about that. I think it's absolutely true that the Way... The part about taking an item at one point, as Kevin said, you know, it's now representing this bigger and bigger piece of the milk check. You know, this is where the future is. I believe that we were told many years ago that we would probably see a day when the cheese that we're producing would be dictated to us by the way that we needed, what proteins we needed, what we could capture our best return on, because it's here today.
Well, Ken and Kevin, thank you so much for the conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
It was great. Thank you.
That is Ken Hyman, who became a licensed cheesemaker at age 16. He is co-owner of Naysonville Dairy near Marshfield. And New York Times business correspondent Kevin Draper, who covers the agricultural industry. Draper traveled to central Wisconsin for reporting on the growth of whey production and how it's changing the dairy industry. Coming up, a Wisconsin economist and skateboarder measures the impact of community skate parks.
Well-constructed skate parks end up having these broader community effects in the sense that they make the park more enjoyable, approachable, and even used by a broad base of users.
That's next from WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a skate park in Milwaukee.
5 years ago, a group of friends in Milwaukee saw potential in an old parking lot under a freeway. WPR's Anya Van Wagtendonk has the story of the National DIY Skate Park, a do-it-yourself project that started out as a secret and has become a part of the fabric of the city.
Drive down National Avenue too fast and you'll miss it. Skaters under a freeway in Milwaukee's Walker's Point neighborhood. On this steamy day, they're out practicing tricks on curbs and quarter pipes in a space that's done a full 180 since the early days of the pandemic. At the time, Dylan Shanahan was living alone and his job was on hold.
The only place where I felt safe or good was when I was riding my skateboard.
But in the city of Milwaukee, there were no public outdoor skate parks. So Shanahan and his friends found other places to skate around the city. One day, his buddy brought him to an old park and ride under the interstate with half an idea.
He's like, you know, we can build that transition like over there, over here. And I was like, but we could build a skate park over here because I just was already in it.
The spot was dark and loud and honestly, gross. There was runoff from car oil and the residue of drug use and tons of trash. Shanahan says that made it perfect.
Like, it's kind of a big reason why we were able to build and everything, because it was just people they couldn't see it or know what we were doing all the whole time, you know, until it was like really growing.
And the transformation happened quickly. Throughout 2020, kids came from across the city to clear out trash and pour cement for the first ramps. Adam Polanski is a veteran of the Milwaukee skate scene. He's owned Sky High Skate Shop since the 90s and says he watched this DIY project blossom naturally.
You know, it has that organic, like, movement. It's a little more exciting because people get to watch as things get added, and it adds more excitement as things move along and things get built up.
Polanski says the National DIY Skate Park, named for National Avenue, filled a decades-old need, and soon it got the city's attention. That could be good or bad, according to Emmy Yates. She started hanging around the park while writing a master's thesis about DIY spaces. She says one of the hallmarks of DIY spaces is fragility. They're built outside official pathways, which means there's room for creativity and freedom and community, but also...
These are very delicate spaces, and they get bulldozed down day of, years in.
The Milwaukee crew says that vulnerability scared them, so they formed a nonprofit, and Going Legit had a snowball effect. Money from the city for better fencing and lights, consulting on an official city skate park nearby, recognition from the mayor. 5 years in, volunteers have poured thousands of hours into building this park. Shanahan estimates he single-handedly carted out thousands of pounds of trash. But as of a few weeks ago, another milestone, city trash cans.
So it's like pretty new. So and like the porta potty as well, like it's like, that's a big deal. When we get a vending machine, I think we'll be on top, you know?
Shanahan glances over at a little boy and girl going down a quarter pipe. He says seeing those kids is kind of the whole point. They'll get to grow up with this place to come to.
That's when it like transcends the responsibility notion and it becomes a full-on mission.
The pillars holding up the freeway are painted with murals by local artists. Eventually, Shanahan says, there'll be landscaping by the road. The collective vision will build out one step at a time. And in a few hours, the sun will go down and the lights will come on, and people will still be out under the freeway, skating in the summer air.
WPR's Anya Van Wagtendonk brought us that story on the National DIY Skate Park in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today. Now, Wisconsin is home to skate parks all over the state. Most of these parks are free and open to the public, drawing newbies and veteran skaters to hone their skills and try out new tricks. A Wisconsin economics professor noticed the impact skate parks were having on local communities. As a longtime skateboarder himself, he decided to study the economic effects of these parks. And he found that skate parks are not only an economic asset, but that they serve as important community hubs. Thomas Kemp is chair and professor in the Department of Economics at UW-Eau Claire. He recently talked with Rob Ferret.
You are an economist now, Tom, but you've been a skater for a lot longer. Share your skateboarding origin story, please.
Sure. Well, I grew up in the Milwaukee area, picked up actually all my little local friends. We all picked up skateboards when we were, you know, in our early teens or tweens, even, I guess. I was 12, and that's 40 years ago now, and really been pretty much skating ever since then. So, yeah, it's been a good activity for me.
Now, did young Thomas Kemp have a skate park nearby?
Well, no, there were no skate parks anywhere near me until the Turf Skate Park reopened, I want to say in 1987. But even that was a long way for, you know, a 15-year-old at the time. I lived a good 30 minutes drive from there. So we got there as often as possible. But yeah, skate parks were very, very few and far in between back in those days.
As an economist, when did it first occur to you that, hey, this thing you've been doing your whole life would be a worthy object of study?
Yeah, that's kind of a funny story. This was about, it was about 5 years ago. A friend of mine, you know, of course, who knows that I'm an economist, handed me a book by a guy named Ian Borden, who's also a professor. And he said, hey, you got to read this. And it was an extremely well done work, citations, whole thing. And I said, oh, my gosh, you know, I can write about skateboarding and it can be like a serious academic endeavor. And that was it. I've been doing that ever since then. It was really a life-changing event.
Now, you've written that skateboarding used to be thought of as a fringe activity, something that the hooligans did, but it's seen a boost in popularity in recent years. What do we know about who is skateboarding now and the numbers involved in the hobby?
Yeah, the numbers are somewhere between 8 and 10 million within the United States, and then about a similar number in the rest of the world. So maybe, you know, maybe as many as 20 million worldwide. But the numbers are really very hard to figure because there's people who maybe bought a skateboard and ride it once a year, and then there's people who ride, you know, every day. So, and the demographics have changed quite a bit. Skateboarding in 2025 looks a lot more like the United States does in general. So it's not just, you know, teenagers, it's very young children. You know, I also involved with teaching lessons here in the Eau Claire area. We have kids as young as 3, 4, and 5 quite commonly. And then there's folks, you know, who are well into their 50s and even 60s that are still skateboarding on a regular basis. So it's much more diverse than certainly it was when I started.
And skateboards, I understand there are skateboarders there, of course, at skate parks, but there are other uses as well, other kinds of recreation. What kind of things are happening in these spaces?
Right. So skate parks, you know, the name, they're called skate parks. But of course, if you pop down to your local skate park, you're going to see people on skateboards, of course, but you're also going to see people on roller skates, both inline and conventional. And you can see kids on, you know, the little kick scooters. You know, you might even see some folks with, in wheelchairs. It's amazing to me, absolutely incredible. But I've seen it on a few occasions, and of course, then bikes as well too. So you see quite a wide variety of users in these places, and that's a great thing.
We invited people to share their local skate parks. Patrick in Madison emailed, says he's a spokes dude for the skate park there. It opened in 2015. And he writes, when the park opened, it was one of the best skate parks in the Midwest. Folks traveled from long distances to check it out. Today, it remains the second most used amenity in the Madison Park system behind the Goodman Pool. He goes on to mention, though, he doesn't have hard numbers on the economic impact. And that takes us to your research, Tom. How do you start to try to figure out the economic impact of a skate park?
So there's a few different impacts from the skate parks. First, you mentioned people traveling, and people certainly do travel to the Madison skate park. I have done so myself many times and will do so again in the next week or so. Of course, when people go to these parks, then they also, you know, they purchase food in the local restaurants. Sometimes there's hotel stays involved, and sometimes there's equipment that gets purchased. And of course, these are also part of the economic impact of these skate parks. What we're really trying to understand right now is how these skate parks become positive community spaces. Sort of what are the factors that cause that to happen, or, you know, in some cases, unfortunately, not to happen. And so we're finding that well-constructed skate parks end up having these sort of broader community effects in the sense that they make the park more enjoyable, approachable, and even used by a broad base of users. So people who aren't skateboarders per se, but they, you know, they might just be somebody who likes to walk the dog there. And now because there's always skateboarders in the park has a population to it. And so it feels safer rather than, you know, sort of being a vacant space where very few users are. And that's just one of the ways in which well-constructed skate parks can contribute to broader community benefits as well, just sort of the intangible economics of them.
Now, your case study that you published on took you to exotic Iowa. You were in Des Moines looking at the Lauritsen yeah. Skate Park. What other kind of lessons did you take away from that?
Yeah, so with big skate parks like that are destination tourism sites. That's what I think we proved pretty conclusively. In that, so we spent 6 days surveying people in the Des Moines skate park, so actual parks users. And about 1 in 5 of those users was traveling from a significant distance a ways away. So outside of the Des Moines metro area with people coming from as far as Florida, and Arizona, Texas, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to go to that skate park. Now, I suspect that the Madison skate park, which we mentioned, probably isn't drawing quite as far and wide as that because it's not as large. But I'm quite sure, again, having done it myself, that it's drawing from maybe a lot further than people appreciate. And similarly, the newly reopened Turf skate park in Milwaukee, that park, I'm sure, is drawing from worldwide. So people are traveling from all over the world to use that park. So they're really truly destination sites.
We're talking to Thomas Kemp, economics professor at UW-Eau Claire, about skateboarding and his research looking at the economic value of local skate parks. We also got an email from Mike and Judy. They're a big part of the group that started the Tosa Skate Park in Wauwatosa. It was built in 2015. They write, "The park provides a safe and accessible space for skateboarding, rollerblading, scootering, and BMX biking, fostering a sense of community and promoting healthy activities." Tom, there's that community again. How do we measure the intangibles of a skate park, like that community building and healthy activities?
Yeah, well, the Tosa folks have a great park there, and it's a great community. I've been to that park and ridden it a number of times, and what they're saying there is very consistent with what we've found. And how we're measuring that is we're actually surveying neighborhoods around these skate parks scattered across Wisconsin and Minnesota. We're asking them specifically about how do they feel about the skate park? Do they feel it's a safe place? You know, would they have their kids there, et cetera? And in that way, we're not really able to grab the quantitative benefits of the skate parks. In that way, we're more trying to figure out the qualitative benefits of it. And we're really trying to figure out what is it that makes for a skate park that maximizes those qualitative benefits in the community. They're not all the same, right? We wouldn't want to walk away from this with thinking that all skate parks are the same, and if I just build a skate park, I'm going to have these wonderful community benefits. They really have to be done right.
To wrap up, Tom, I want to give you a chance to evangelize about skating. Now, I figure if I started, we'd quickly have an economic case study in healthcare. But for other people who are less prone to breaking themselves, make the case for checking out skateboarding.
Yeah, I think there's actually a bunch of studies out there that show that skateboarding is a valid way to maintain one's health as a young adult, but even as one gets older. It's, you know, especially in these days where we have screens all the time and we're constantly being fed information from those screens, it's really a great way to get back in touch with your physical environment and your local community. You know, not everybody needs to go totally gung-ho. You know, skateboarding can be a relatively low-impact activity if it's practiced in an appropriate way. And so I'd really encourage folks, you know, if they, you know, maybe they skateboarded when they were younger and they're thinking like, oh, like I need to do something to get healthy. You know, maybe this is a solution for them. Just get that old skateboard out and start by rolling down the driveway and then maybe you roll down the street and maybe after you get your confidence up, you head back over to the skate park a little bit and roll around a bit there. I think you're going to have a lot of fun if you do.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, no, thank you.
That is Tom Kemp, an economist who teaches at UW-Eau Claire. He talked with Rob Verrett about his new research into the economic and community value of local skate parks. A Madison storyteller has been on a Midwest bagel quest for over a year now, honoring her New York City roots and trying to track down where to get a fantastic bagel close to home here in Wisconsin. So ahead of this conversation, could you offer your own bagel intel? What is your favorite bagel and why? Have you found one that has just the right crisp and flaky exterior? And then what about that chewy interior? Of course, flavors. Do you have one and only one? Is it savory or sweet? Maybe both. As for me, I'm a Brugger's gal. I grew up on Brugger's, and my high school friends would get jobs at the bagel shop and have a ready supply of day-olds to pass around. They're still so good. Tell us all about bagels. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch with us on bagels. That number, 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Mackenzie Crummy, and Rochelle Wilson. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Tim Peterson is managing producer, and Dean Knetter is our executive producer. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.